Ready? Sound is okay? Good. How about you? You're okay? Yeah? That's good. Great. I'm glad.
The camera's not okay.
They have the audio, okay, well. Thank you for coming to sit. I'm always surprised that so many people want to sit. It's good though, I'm happy about it. And I think that the sitting that you are doing is more important than you think. I hope you had an enjoyable day. Sometimes sitting can be a little difficult, but even so, I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope that you think that it's helping you in some way, helping your life in some way. Maybe you're not sure whether it's helping or if it is helping, it's not clear how it's helping. But anyway, I hope you feel encouraged and inspired to keep it up, because it's a good thing to do. I'm always thinking about our practice, especially when I have to say something about it. I better think about it, right? So I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, you know, I think that Zazen, the way that we understand it in our tradition, it's a kind of mystical practice. It's a kind of mystical activity. I didn't look it up. I'm sure I could find different official definitions of mysticism. But to me, mysticism means basically experiential. It means a practice that is about experience, not about faith or doctrine or following rules, but that's a practice that's personal and direct, personal and direct experience. And we all have a personal and direct experience in our Zazen. And in the beginning, you know, it's kind of famous in Zen, when Zen was the first Zen ancestor in China, Bodhidharma defined his practice that way, touching the mind, touching the heart directly without reliance on scriptures. So you could say, I think, that Zen is a kind of very essential form of mysticism. But even before Zen, for the Buddha too, that was also the case. The Buddha was also looking for a direct experience that would show him reality as it truly is, because he could see that that would be the only way that he could overcome the basic human suffering that he sensed came from a profound misunderstanding about life. So he sought a direct experience that would show him how life was and thereby overcome suffering. And that's exactly what he did. We call this Buddha's awakening. And so when we sit, we are also striving to see for ourselves. Now, there's no special something in particular that we're striving to see, because there is no one size fits all something. Everyone is perfectly unique in this world. Everyone is a perfectly unrepeatable expression of life. So naturally, we're going to see uniquely, but oddly, paradoxically, at the same time, what we see is the same thing that the Buddha saw. We will see for ourselves, in our own way, the same thing that the Buddha saw and that Bodhidharma saw. So we're mystics. Did you know? And mysticism is very colorful. And if you study about mystics in all the different traditions, you will find some pretty extreme and outrageous types. Mystics often have very dramatic lives full of incredible suffering and equal heights of ecstatic experience. And Kathy has been telling us in her wonderful Dharma talks this month, great stories about the first Buddhist nuns. If you haven't been attending the seminar, the talks are online, you can listen to them. Amazing stories, really. Amazing stories. People who, some of them seemingly, who went in one step from the most unimaginable and horrific grief to the point of literal madness to awakening, seemingly in one step. And that is not so unusual. That's a lot of times the way it goes. Our deepest suffering brings us to sublime awakening. And although the Buddha, as we know, was concerned about ending suffering, it was very often through the suffering that suffering would come to an end. And I say this because I think it would be a good thing for any of us to think, when we do have suffering in our lives, whether it's dramatic suffering or not so dramatic suffering, that we might want to think about it in that way. Not as something that's unfortunate, some mistake that we could correct, something that's your fault or somebody else's fault, but rather as the impetus that we need, the energy that we need to discover the truth. And when you practice Zazen, you will see how that can be so. But Zazen is a dark path. And what I mean by that is, Zazen is not something that you figure out or get good at. There is no step-by-step manual that shows you what you're supposed to be doing in Zazen. Zazen brings you to what you need every time, but without your ever quite knowing how that comes about. So you have to be patient, and you have to be trusting. Because Zazen, just like your life, is more than anyone can know. Knowing is actually quite crude, not that subtle, and it only goes so far. I think in our world now we have a vast overestimation of understanding something, knowing something. When through your effort over time, an effort that you're right now engaged in, you will establish your seat in Zazen, you will have great confidence in life, great confidence in the Dharma, and great confidence in yourself. Not your conditioned self, which may be a mess in all kinds of ways, but your true self, your Buddha self. And you will realize that you possess this Buddha self, just like every other living thing. And this will give you tremendous confidence and equally tremendous humility, because you will realize that you are just exactly like everyone else. And everyone else is exactly like you. So I'm talking about mysticism because today I want to tell you a story about a great mystic, one of the great mystics of all time. Some of you will have heard of this famous mystic who lived in 19th century Ukraine. His name was Rebbe Nachman of Breslov. And he had a very dramatic life. He saw visions. He received hidden and secret teachings that he could never reveal. He got in lots of trouble with his colleagues, and he often had to flee one village for another because he was in a dispute with this one or that one. Tragically, he lost a young son. He lost his wife. He was on the point of death himself. He's very famous for his book, which is reputed to have been one of the great mystical treatises ever written. But when he fell deathly ill, he was convinced that it was this book that was killing him, and that in order to remain alive, even for a little while longer, he would have to burn this book. So he dispatched his disciples to find the book in his locked up in his drawer, and they burned it, so that no one has ever read this book, and no one ever will. It's Rebbe Nachman's famous burnt book that exists only in legend. A contemporary rabbi wrote a book about Rebbe Nachman not long ago in which he posthumously diagnosed Rebbe Nachman with bipolar syndrome, manic depression, you know, which maybe is true. Who knows? But if he did have this disease, in his case, it was a divine disease. Can you imagine? Rebbe Nachman died at the age of 38. 38, from tuberculosis, which so many of the most brilliant people in that century perished from that disease. He was famous for telling stories. Lots of stories of Rebbe Nachman exist, written down after, he didn't write them down, but they were written down after he told them. And some of them are very strange and bizarre and impossible to understand. But this afternoon, I want to tell you one that I think it's not that long. Some of them are very, very long. Some of them it took him weeks to tell over, you know, once a week he would tell a part and then the next part and the next part. This one was told in one sitting, so it's not so long. And the story is called The Humble King, and I'm going to tell you the story. Once there was a king who had a wise man, and the king said to the wise man, "There is a king, a different king, who is said to be very mighty. But also he designates himself as a man of truth and as a very humble king. Now, mighty. I understand that. I know that he's mighty, since his kingdom is surrounded by the sea, and on the sea stands a navy all around, and on the navy there are warships with cannons, and no one can come close to the country. And inwards from the sea, there's a marsh surrounding the country, quicksand, and there is one narrow path, wide enough for one person to cross, that crosses over that marsh. And there, too, there are cannons positioned so that if someone comes to attack, the cannons are fired so that it's impossible to come close to there. So I understand how he's mighty. But a man of truth and humble, this I don't know. And I want you to bring me a portrait of this king so that I can understand. Because apparently this king possesses portraits of all the kings, but the portrait of this particular king is not to be found, since this particular king is hidden from all the people. He sits in the inner room of his palace, wrapped round with many layers of curtains, and no one in the country has ever seen him. Get me a portrait of that king. So, the wise man went to this country, and he came to the realization that in order to find the king, he must discover the essence of this country. And how do you find out the essence of a country? By way of its jokes. Because if you want to know the essence of a culture, you should study its jokes. For there are lots of kinds of jokes. One kind of joke is the kind of joke told by someone who means to harm someone else. And he tells the joke about a friend, and the friend is very upset by this joke. But he says to the friend, "Don't worry, I'm only joking." Not a very nice kind of joke. But there is that kind of a joke, and there are all kinds of other kinds of jokes. So the wise man determined that he would find out, the first thing he had to do was find out the essence of this country by its jokes. Now, among all the countries, there is a country that embodies all the other countries. And within that country, there is a city that embodies all the cities of the whole country, which embodies all the other countries. And in that city, there is a house that embodies all the houses of that city, that embodies all the cities of that country, that embodies all the countries. And in that house, there's a man who embodies everything in that house, that embodies all the houses of the city, that embodies all the cities of the country, that embodies all the countries. And that man is the person who makes all the wisecracks and jokes that will express the character of that country. So the wise man realized that probably he was going to need a lot of money. So he raised a whole bunch of money, and he went to this place. And in that purse, in that house, with that person, he could see all the wisecracks and jokes, not only of the whole country, but also of the whole world. And he understood from the jokes that the entire country was full of falsehood from beginning to end. Because he saw them making all kinds of jokes about how people are cheated and ripped off in business. And how someone who gets cheated and ripped off in business goes to the local court for justice, but the courts are completely full of falsehood, and they accept bribery there. But the only thing the bribery accomplishes is to get your case up to the next level of court, and you go to that court, and you bribe that court, and all that happens is you get up to the next level, and that's how it goes. You go from court to court, and nothing happens, and there's no justice, but you have doled out a tremendous amount of money, because everything is totally corrupt. And all this was normal and acceptable, and the people were making parodies of all this stuff, and they were making jokes about it, and everybody was laughing uproariously about how corrupt the society was. So the wise man fully understood from this, joking, that the entire country is filled with falsehood and deceit, completely lacking any truthfulness. So now he knew what he needed to know about the country, and now he made a plan of action. He went out with his money and made some business deals, and of course, he was ripped off in the transactions. So he went to court, and he bribed the court, and he went up to the next level of court, and he bribed that level of court, and he went up to the next level of court, court after court. He bribed his way all the way up the chain of judicial authority until all the way he got to the Supreme Court, which was totally corrupt, and he bribed there, and he finally, that way, got to see the king, who was the highest authority of all. Now, when he came to see the king, he said, "Look at this country that you're king of. The entire country is full of falsehood from top to bottom. Not a speck of truthfulness anywhere in it." And the wise man began to explain to the king all the details of how corrupt this country was, how the business deals were always crooked, how people with lots of money always managed to take advantage of everyone else, which enabled them to amass still more money so they were able to take even more advantage of everyone else, and how if you brought them to the courts, the only thing that happened was you paid a lot of bribes to the court and you never got any satisfaction. And everybody thought this was hilarious and they joked about it. Everybody was full of cynical laughter about how everybody was so cruel and unjust to one another. No truthfulness found anywhere. This is your country. And he went into more and more detail about this. And as he's telling this, the king is bending his ear closer and closer to the curtain behind which he's sitting because he was astonished that there existed someone aware of all the details of all the falsehood of the country and could understand it so precisely and so clearly. The royal ministers witnessing all this were getting very, very uncomfortable. But the wise man continued to report this. And the king listened with more and more incredulity and agitation, which the wise man could sense even behind all these layers of curtains. The wise man then said, "When I arrived here, of course I assumed that you, king, must be also full of falsehood and deceit, since this is your country, and this is the way the country is. But now I can see, by the way you're listening to me with such astonishment, that it's not so, that you are a man of truth. And now I understand why you keep yourself hidden behind all these curtains, invisible to your subject. It's because you can't bear the falsehood of this country. And for this, the wise man began to praise the king." Now, this king was very pure and very humble. And like all humble people, he was not really equipped to handle praise. The more praise that was heaped on him, the more humble he became. He never could get puffed up from the praise. He just kept getting more and more humble. So the king is getting more humble. The wise man is praising him more and more. The king is getting more humble. He's literally becoming smaller and smaller and smaller on account of this huge amount of praise that the wise man, who is very eloquent, is heaping on him. And the king became so humble and so small that he literally became nothing. Nothing. That's what happened. So the king is now nothing. And he couldn't restrain himself anymore. He threw aside the curtain to see this wise man, this person who lavished all this praise on his truthfulness, this person who was able to understand and know exactly how corrupt this country was. So he threw aside the curtain, and when he threw aside the curtain, the king's face was revealed. The wise man saw it, and this is how he was able to bring the portrait back to his king. And that's the end of the wacky story of Rabbi Nachman. I'm sure you could easily point out various things about the story that make no sense whatsoever, are self-contradictory and so on, but never mind about that. It's a mystical story, after all. It couldn't possibly make sense, because all mystical stories are always include hidden elements that you cannot understand. That's what makes them mystical. It's like Zazen. You know, you don't understand Zazen. How could you? It's hidden. Nevertheless, I will interpret this story. Even though I know my interpretation will have nothing to do with the story. But we're having fun here, so we'll interpret. So this king is mighty. We learn that he's mighty, because he lives on an island surrounded by water and protected by cannons and battleships. What does this tell us? This tells us that being mighty does not mean that we dominate others, that we need to have control over anyone. It means that we simply need to be self-sufficient, complete in ourselves. We don't need to depend on others for our self-worth. We feel it in our own body and breath, and it's enough. That's how we become mighty. We don't need to be aggressive in any way. The single lane that leads into the country through the surrounding swamp, the lane that only one person at a time can enter. It reminds me of Rabbi Nachman's most famous saying, which I think is very brilliant and very moving. He says, the entire world is a narrow bridge. Don't be afraid. Isn't that a wonderful saying? The entire world is a narrow bridge. Don't be afraid. So this is a narrow bridge. And this tells us that if we want to enter into the heart of things, all the way to the center, where the truth is hidden, we have to go alone and quietly. The path is narrow. It's wide enough exactly for you. No wider and no narrower. But don't get distracted. Don't fall off. This is quicksand all around. And the idea that jokes is the way that you tell about a country is kind of strange. But maybe it's true, you know? Maybe that's why they tell me that stand-up comedy is very popular now. A friend of ours said, oh, our son is dating a woman who's a stand-up comic. There's a lot of stand-up comics who are very smart. I think they actually are telling us who we are. It's an odd thought that the way to understand the world is through its jokes. And it's sort of chillingly apt, isn't it? This exaggerated idea of a world so full of falsehood, so corrupt and full of pain, that what is truest and best in it has to hide in the middle. I think we're all like that in some way, you know, we're all, I think, shocked by the world the way it is. There's something in us that hides deep, deep, deep within us, ourselves, because we can't bear the way the world is. And the world does sometimes appear to be a kind of a cruel and crude joke, doesn't it? The idea that you need to shout and yell to be heard, that you need to spruce up your brand just to get by. Maybe you even need to run roughshod over other people, hurt other people to make sure you're okay. Maybe even you have to be violent. You have to take them hostage. You have to torture them. You have to bomb them. You have to invade their country. You have to start a civil war that's going to create starvation and chaos. These are just things that are everyday news, normal things, everyday things. That can't be real, right? That's got to be some kind of a sick joke. Who would do things like that when everybody knows that there's no one in the entire world who wants that stuff? Nobody wants that. Who says, yes, that's a good idea? Nobody says that. And yet, this happens. It's a sick joke. Just the idea that the world is a tough place where everybody is out to get you and you have to be clever and tough to make your way through it, that is a crazy idea. Crazy idea that could only lead to stress and unhappiness. To see that the world is me against you, us against them, that's got to be a crazy stand-up comic routine. That cannot possibly be the way people look at it. And yet, when has it not been that way? It's not that funny. And only a wise person, like maybe the Buddha, can see that all conditioned existence is suffering, and that attachment to self and the preservation of false concepts of self and other is the cause of this suffering, is the horrible punchline of this truly terrible joke. the hidden king in the very center of all this, I would say, is our true nature, our true self, which is loving and kind. Buddha nature, true nature, things as they are, whatever you call it. Doesn't matter what you call it. These are just words. But we feel it. No doubt. Rabbi Nachman called it God, the hidden and ineffable God. God is always hidden, true nature, Buddha nature is always hidden. Because although there is no place where it is not, it's always in plain sight. We can't see it because our eyes are broken. We studied about this in detail some while ago when we were studying Vasubandhu's three natures. Vasubandhu teaches that we see an imaginary world. We see a world of jokes because our human consciousness will naturally perceive an unreal world of substance and separation, and that is not the way the world actually is. Do zazen long enough, and you will get the joke. The many jokes that make up this world. And you know the funniest joke of all? You. Me and you. That's the funniest joke of all. And once you have a feeling for this, you can't exactly know it because it's not knowable. That's the whole point. You can't know it. If you could know it, it wouldn't be the truth. It would be some fancy idea. Maybe you could put up a website with this idea and join the jokes and, I don't know, maybe you could become a very famous spiritual master, and et cetera, et cetera. But no, you can't know it, but you can feel it in your body, in your breath. And when you get the joke, maybe you can laugh gently. But for sure, you will cry. Because this joke is on all of us poor people of the world. God bless us all, you know, we have no idea what we're doing. And yet we have to suffer for our own stupidity. And we don't even understand the meaning of our own suffering. When you appreciate the truth and you love it and you praise it, as the wise man does, the truth becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, and then it becomes nothing. Just like in the Heart Sutra, you know, nothing. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no suffering, no cause of suffering, no end of suffering, no path, no attainment. Nothing. And this nothing is exactly everything. That's the mystical part. And this is our freedom. There's nothing to possess, nothing to understand, nothing to lose. Your suffering, my suffering, and the suffering of the world is light as air, insubstantial, to be endured and appreciated and deeply, deeply understood. Maybe you were confused at the end of the story. How do you make a portrait of nothing? Right? The king became nothing. How do you make a portrait of the king that's nothing? You can't make a portrait of nothing. Yes, you can. Everything is a portrait of nothing. All dharmas are empty. And the most important portrait of all is you. Your life, moment by moment. Your human life is a portrait of the truth. There is significance in every human life, way beyond anything you can imagine or think. I can see the truth. Any one of us can see the truth in every person we meet. The beauty and the poignancy of that life. If only we could see it. Now, I've been going on and on about mysticism, but what's great about our tradition is that it's very plain and down-to-earth mysticism. Whew. We save all that drama. We don't have to go to those heights and depths. It's just every day. So we have lots of mystical experiences all the time. It's just that they're not quite so exciting as those of Rabbi Nachman. So our path is good because we don't have to suffer that much. Suzuki Roshi said, the world is its own magic. That's what he meant. Just to be alive in this truly fabulous world, that's the hidden truth. That's the humility hidden at the heart of things. So I'm going to close with some words from my own teacher who was like Suzuki Roshi, a very down-to-earth teacher, a complete mystic, and you'd never know. So this is his book is just a posthumously published book just out called Seeing One Thing Through, Sojin Mel Weitzman. And I'll read a page for you, and then I'll stop. Today, I was looking through a book for a spark to set off this talk and ran across an old question from a student who asked, the phrase, nothing special, keeps coming up for me. Could you please talk about its meaning? It's a good question, which is the heart of our practice. Suzuki Roshi used this phrase a lot. Back in the 60s, when young people were looking for profound experiences in psychedelics, some were investigating meditation. D.T. Suzuki was popularizing a side of Rinzai style that emphasized koan training leading up to kensho, or sudden awakening. But Suzuki Roshi's training in the Soto school led him to understand that what brings us to practice is our inherently enlightened mind, hidden in there behind the curtain. Suzuki Roshi did not encourage attainment. He said that when we are always looking over there for something, it's harder to appreciate where we are right now. With this understanding, grasses, pebbles, and streams are always preaching the Dharma and teaching us how to act. So there is nothing special to achieve. And yet everything is special in its own unique way and should be fully respected and appreciated as a form of Buddha nature. Recently, we were studying the Buddhist precepts of different schools. Some have 250, others have 16, some have none. Suzuki Roshi respected them, but his understanding was that precepts are simply our way of navigating our life. When we pay attention to our surroundings and keep our senses and mind unassuming and open, everything we encounter brings us back to our compassionate, joyful, and harmonious practice. It is not that we ignore enlightening moments, but even when they are extraordinary, they are at the same time not more extraordinary than the ordinary sight of the divine light of a periwinkle by the side of the road. So that's our style of mystical experience. So now, following our custom that might be new to some of you, I don't know, we always get into groups of three to discuss the Dharma together. And maybe I'll just very briefly give you an instruction of how we do this, and then you'll get in groups of three. Everybody is going to talk for maybe 3 minutes, and I'll ring a bell after 3 minutes. 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes. And I'm going to give you a question that I want you to talk about if you can, and then you just listen. Everybody listens. We agree, and you'll tell me, please, if you do not agree, that we will be generous and confidential in our listening. We will not repeat what we hear. And we will listen as much as possible, as if we were sitting zazen, just letting things come and go without judgment. Okay? Okay, that way it's safe, right? You don't need to worry. Everybody's going to support you. And therefore, you can say something that surprises you. Something you didn't know you thought. Because most of what we say socially is stuff that we have rehearsed. We know it's okay to say these things because we said them over and over again. But the truth might be something unexpected. So surprise yourself. And if you don't have 3 minutes of stuff to say, that's okay. We can be silent together. That 3 minutes is for you only. Nobody's going to jump in and take your time. It's your time. 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes. Okay? So that's the only rule, is to listen generously. Don't interrupt the speaker. And when it's your turn to speak, don't be commenting on what the other person said. No, no. Just say what's coming up for you. Okay? And we'll do the same thing online. They'll be in groups of three. So right now, if we could self-organize very quickly in a minute or two into groups of three, moving your chairs or cushions around. And as I always say, let's have old-timers, if possible, find people they don't know so that we're not just talking to people that we know. So very quickly, we'll organize, and then I'm going to tell you my question for you. Okay, are we all set? Okay.